going to start the State Government Finance Committee meeting. We do not have a quorum yet, but I see Chair Davids is here. Chair Davids, if you want to come to the table, we'll start with your bill first. You want to describe it, and then what we'll do is once we get a quorum, I'm going to pause you, take care of some business, and then we'll be able to move your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, House File 1269 is a bill that, well, under current law, a public employee is entitled to 15 days of paid leave each year for National Guard or Military Reserve service. This bill requires the Adjutant General to administer the reimbursement grant program to reimburse local units of government for paying salary and benefits to public safety employees on this leave. So it applied to peace officers, firefighters, and ambulance service personnel. And Madam Chair, if you look at the fiscal note, 15 and 16, there's no cost. 17 and 18 is about $1.55 million and then $1.58 million for a total in the next biennium of $3.160, a little over $3 million. So that's basically what the bill does. I have a gentleman here that would like to make a few comments.
Great. If you can please state your name for the record and who you represent.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Chris Parsons. I'm president of the Minnesota Professional Firefighters. We represent 1,600 professional firefighters, EMTs, paramedics around the state and over 40 communities around the state of Minnesota. I'm here in support of this bill. The fire service employs many current and former members of our nation's armed forces. In fact, many of the traditions of the modern fire service, from our rank structure all the way down to our blue uniforms, can claim the roots from many of the soldiers that returned to civilian life after our country's Civil War. Our state's fire departments are a natural fit for our citizen soldiers, and they have, by and large, proven time and time again to be assets to the respective communities. Add this to that Minnesota provides military veterans preference in hiring for government jobs, and it's no wonder that the fire service employs a disproportionate amount of former and current soldiers. This bill sets up a grant program to allow local government units that employ servicemen and women in public safety roles to recoup a portion of the costs incurred when these men and women must miss work in order to complete their military service up to 15 days per year. Minnesota statute requires public employers provide paid time off in these cases. Minnesota has been a leader in supporting its members of the armed forces, especially in the area of expanding employment rights. In my 15 years in the fire service, however, I have witnessed how the paid time off provision can provide a negative impact in the area of public safety. My employer, for example, the St. Paul Fire Department, employs roughly 30 firefighters that also are members of the armed forces. It's not uncommon to have around 10% of our department off on military leave when long-term deployments intersect with military training begins. In order to maintain our current minimum staffing number, the department must replace our citizen soldiers with costly overtime, which includes salary and benefits for a 24-hour day and can exceed about $1,000 per replacement. In 2014, the St. Paul Fire Department covered about 602 shifts of overtime due to military leave. This, of course, is not just a St. Paul issue, it's a statewide issue, and it's proportional depending on the size of the community. Minneapolis, similar size, spends about the same. In fact, in Minneapolis, 22 of their last 24 firefighter hires have been military veterans. Duluth spends about $100,000 per year on military leave, Rochester about $30,000. On salary, not including overtime costs. St. Cloud also spends about $30,000 per year. The other side of this coin is what happens when budgets shrink and belts tighten, as they did during our most recent recession. In St. Paul, as in other cities across the state, the answer was often to operate fire companies below the national minimum safety staffing standards, or to shut them down for the day, which meant a reduction in service for our communities. Understaffing is also a danger to firefighters, as it has been proven to be a significant factor in firefighter injuries and fatalities.
I'm going to pause you right there, and I'm going to officially call the State Government Finance Committee meeting to order. Members, there's minutes in your packet for March 26. Representative Petersburg moves the minutes. For March 26, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? The minutes for March 26 are approved. With that, I'm going to move House File 1269. For possible conclusion in the omnibus state government finance bill. With that, Chair Davids, do I have any other testimony?
I'm not aware of any.
Okay. Is there anyone else from the public that wishes to testify for this bill or have comments to this bill? Welcome. If you can please state your name for the record and who you represent.
Good morning, Madam Chairman and members. My name is Grace Kelleher, and I represent the Minnesota School Boards Association. And we are excited about the amendment that was added. We think it's productive to put in teachers as well as administrators to use this program. School districts face an interesting hurdle that other local governments don't, is we have to have a substitute. If a teacher is in front of children every day, there has to be a sub immediately as they're deployed. So in the past, none of those costs were covered. They were all taken in by the school district, and a small district in particular, this can come as a difficult hit. And we want to thank Representative Davids and his leadership on this. This would be very helpful to encourage, just to support our veterans across all boards and school districts. So, Madam Chair, we are very supportive of this and the amendment.
Okay. And Representative Nelson, do you want to speak to your amendment? A1 amendment, members in your packet.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The amendment I have is the A1 amendment, and basically what it does is add school district employees, or public employees employed by a school district in positions of teacher, as teachers to the bill. Under current law, teachers are part of the law that allows them the 15 days paid leave off. And if this bill, I think it's a good bill. It's about relieving unfunded mandates that we as the state have imposed on our local governments. And this would help relieve our school districts of an unfunded mandate, one of many, but that's my amendment. So I move the A1 amendment.
Okay. Chair Davids to the amendment.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Nelson, for the amendment. The only concern I would have, and I agree, I think it's a good idea to do it, would be the fiscal note when that comes out, to see how that all, but I guess that's your issue, not
yes.
It's all of our issue, of course, but that's the only thing. I'm at about $3 million into the next biennium now. That I don't know what the fiscal note will do, but I guess we'll find out.
Yes.
If the committee decides to put it on.
Great. Members, any questions to the amendment?
Madam Chair,
Representative Nelson.
I'd like a roll call.
You like a roll call? Okay. Representative Nelson likes a roll call. Is there anyone else from the public that wishes to testify to the A1 amendment? Okay. Seeing none, members, we're going to take the roll call.
Representative Sarah Anderson.
Aye.
Representative Jeff Howe.
Aye.
Representative Sheldon Johnson.
Aye.
Representative Tony Albright. Representative Mark Anderson.
Aye.
Representative Lyndon Carlson.
Aye.
Representative Bob Detmer. Representative Ron Earhart. Representative Phyllis Kahn. Representative Caroline Lane.
Mm-hmm. Aye.
Mm-hmm. Representative Bob Lunin.
Aye.
Representative Jim Nash.
Aye.
Representative Michael Nelson.
Aye.
Representative John Petersburg.
Aye.
Representative Cindy Pugh.
Aye.
Representative Linda Frumbeck.
Aye.
And Representative Jennifer Schultz.
Aye.
Mm-hmm. 13 ayes, the amendment passes. Representative Davids, I should ask members, do you have questions? Representative Carlson.
Madam Chair, either of the author or maybe staff, we say local units of government and all school districts, but would that cover, for example, the airport?
Chair Davids?
I would defer to staff on that.
Mr. Shepherd?
Madam Chair and members, no. It says county, home rule, city, or a school district, no.
Yeah, Madam Chair, Twin City International Airport and probably some of the other airports around the state have a number of public safety employees, including firefighters and so on. When I was teaching, I used to bring in the personnel director from the airport to talk about all the different occupations at the airport, and it's really, it was quite an interesting list of occupations, but many of those occupations were public safety, and I don't have an amendment today, but if the bill moves forward, perhaps we should give some consideration to those public safety employees as well.
Representative Nelson.
No, I didn't have my hand up.
Oh, Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm not sure if this would be a question to, maybe no one, but just in as much as it's a public policy matter, it seems like it would have made sense to have heard it in a policy committee, whether it was public safety or veterans or GovOps. So I'll just make that more as a note than anything else, unless you, Madam Chair, or Chair Davids has any comment, but it seems like that would have been a reasonable, good policy procedure to take, too.
Chair Davids, do you
want
to comment?
Well, yeah, thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Johnson. This is, it's already allowed the 15 days, and it's just a matter of who, so it's pretty much strictly finance. The policy's already there. It's already policy, of course, now with the new amendment that, you know, adds something to it. But that's still that's still just the money. We're talking about money, and so there's really no, I mean, the policy doesn't really change other than the reimbursement, which is a finance issue. Okay. I just go where my card tells me to go every day.
<It's> just, I don't smart man. Representative Howe.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess my question, it looks like this adds a requirement to the Attorney General. How does the TAG feel about having to apply this process, and how, what process is he going to use to select what cities get it and what cities don't? How's that going to flow?
Chair David.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Maybe we could have them come up and make a few comments.
Welcome. If you can please state your name for the record and who you represent.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Don Kerr, the Executive Director for the Department of Military Affairs. With regard to Representative Howe's question, the agency does not, we're not opposed to the bill, we're not really supporting the bill. We see advantages and disadvantages to the bill. With regard to the specific methodology that we would use, as we've looked at how we think the bill, if it passes as it's written, would kind of require us to look at this as a one-time, once-a-year grant that would cover an entire year. So we'd have to put a process in place for units of government to report for a calendar year and then disperse the funding probably in the first quarter of the next calendar year. That's the way we're envisioning it right now, though that's kind of open to a lot more staff work that we'd have to do based on what the bill looks like in its final form. But since there's a provision to say if there aren't adequate funds to pay all of the requests, they have to be prorated, it would be difficult for us to pay as we went unless we had a tremendous amount of money sitting there that we knew we would not exceed the requirement. Does that make sense?
Representative Howe?
I guess so. This is going to be a reimbursement after the fiscal year is over.
Mr. Kerr?
Madam Chair, Representative Howe, I believe after the calendar year, the way the bill is written, as I recall.
Representative Howe?
Thank you, Madam Chair. All right. So there's not going to be any guarantees that the cities or the school districts are going to get this, all of the money. They're just going to get a portion of it depending upon how many folks use it and how many calendar days are used by the affected jurisdictions and the affected members.
Mr. Kerr?
Madam Chair, Representative Powell, again, the way the bill is written right now, depending on how much money the legislature appropriates into the grant fund, it directs that we prorate that against all of the valid claims that were made. And again, adding the teachers in will have an impact on the fiscal note.
Representative Howe?
Thank you, Madam Chair. So do you have an estimate? Or is it how many public employees this is going to affect?
We have an estimate in the fiscal note. Sorry, Madam Chair and Representative Howe. There is an estimate in the fiscal note for the public safety employees. We have not run the numbers for the teachers yet. It's not a real significant number. Again, our analysis showed that $3 million in the biennium would likely pay all the grants for the folks that we believe are public safety employees in local units of government.
Representative Howe, any follow-up?
No.
Members, any other questions? Okay, with that, I renew my motion that House File 1269 be laid over for possible inclusion in the State Government Finance Omnibus Bill. Thank you, Chair Davids.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
Members, we're going to move on to House File 437. Representative Scott.
Good morning, Madam Chair.
Representative Nash is going to move House File 437. Welcome, Representative Scott. Can you give us a description of your bill, please?
Thank you. House File 437 would establish a legislative surrogacy commission to examine the many considerations associated with surrogacy arrangements in Minnesota. Although surrogacy arrangements are currently happening in limited numbers in Minnesota, the legislature has not declared surrogacy contracts legal, meaning that a judge has no duty to enforce a surrogacy contract. Over the past decade, bills have been introduced that would legalize surrogacy contracts in Minnesota. These bills never pass. We have hit a political stalemate, and that is why it's time to do something different. This bill is very straightforward. It creates a bipartisan commission of legislators and public officials to receive testimony and engage in a fact-finding process about surrogacy arrangements. The commission will report its findings to the whole legislature, allowing us to be in a better position to consider appropriate legislation. We have worked hard with interested groups to get the language in the shape you see it in today. After every committee hearing, I have invited people to work with me on the bill language and have two short amendments, just voice amendments that would make it reflect recent discussions.
Representative Scott, what are your two amendments that you're looking to do?
On line 2.11 and 2.12, so it currently reads business practices in the fertility industry, including attorneys, brokers, and clinics. And I would like to say practices, regulations, and relationships of the various businesses involved in surrogacy arrangements.
Mr. Shepard, did you get that?
No, Madam Chair.
I can go much lower.
Yeah, that would be helpful, Representative Scott. We're on page 2, line 11. Right. After business practices, you insert
regulations and relationships of the various businesses involved in surrogacy arrangements. And I don't know if you, Madam Chair, if you would like two separate amendments or just one other change. I have.
We're just going to pause here first. Okay. I think we'll just do this one first. Mr. Shepard, can you walk us through what this amendment does?
Madam Chair, members, Representative Scott, I just wanted to make sure, were you deleting all of lines 2.11 and 2.12, or were you keeping in business practices?
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Shepard, deleting lines 2.11 and 2.12 and then just substituting the new language.
Oh. So, okay. So it doesn't say...
Well, business practice, business would stay.
It's everything after business, after practices of the fertility industry would be deleted.
Yes, Madam Chair. Thank you.
Okay, so... okie-dokie. Mr. Shepard, do you want to repeat, or should I? I think I've got it, so let me repeat it, and Representative Scott, you tell me if I've got it correct. So on page 2, line 11, it starts off with business practices, regulations, and relationships of the various businesses involved in surrogacy arrangements, period, or semicolon. and then the words of the fertility industry, including attorneys, brokers, and clinics, is stricken. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, I don't have... Yes, that's correct. Yep.
So, again, members, it should say business practices, comma, regulations, and relationships of the various businesses involved in surrogacy arrangements. Is that, Mr. Yes. Shepherd?
Yes, Madam Chair, I have it, and I can write that up in proper form.
Okay, that would be helpful. Okay, and to the effect of that, what are we changing here, in essence?
Madam Chair, this was just compromise language that we reached with some of the stakeholders.
Okay. Representative Scott, what's the other one you have?
On lines 2.23 to 2.24, which is number 10, we would like it to say appropriate information to be provided to a child born of a surrogate about the child's biological and gestational parents.
Okay, so you're just inserting the word appropriate. Is that correct?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Okay. And Representative Scott, do you have a definition of what appropriate would mean?
I do not, Madam Chair.
Yes.
Okay.
I think the concern was that information to be provided, information was broader than appropriate, rather than information could have included more information than what appropriate would mean. I guess basically they're wanting the child to be able to have some of their biological history, their health information, that sort of thing.
Okay. Members, do you have any questions to the two proposed amendments? Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Scott. You said the stakeholders came up with the change. Could you tell me who the stakeholders are so I have some idea what the context is?
I know Outfront Minnesota and the Minnesota Family Council were the two that I know of that reached this.
Okay, agreement. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Members, any other questions to these two amendments? Anyone from the audience that wishes to speak to these amendments? Seeing none. To the amendment, though. Okay, not seeing any to the amendment. All those in favor of the amendments, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Okay, we've got the bill in the order in which you wish to have it. Representative Scott, are there any more comments that you wish to have to the bill as amended?
Not at this time, Madam Chair. I would just take questions that any members might have, or if you want to take testimony first, that's fine, too.
I think we're going to have the testifiers come forward. So anyone that wishes to speak to the bill, if you could please come forward. Come on up. And if you, if there's others that wish to speak to the bill, if you can come forward and sit in those chairs right behind Representative Scott, that will just help the flow of things, okay? Ms. Leva, if you can please state your name for the record and who you represent.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Autumn Leva, and I am the Policy Director for Minnesota Family Council. And I testify today in support of Representative Scott's commission to study surrogacy arrangements and the global surrogacy industry's potential impact on Minnesota. Right now, as Representative Scott said, there are virtually no regulations on the surrogacy industry. Anyone is able to start a surrogacy agency, and there are no federal regulations to determine who can run this type of agency and which regulations they need to follow. There are no state-specific laws or licensure requirements, and while there are recommended guidelines published by mental health, medical, and legal professionals, as I believe one of the testifiers in opposition to the bill will speak to, these guidelines are not mandatory. And before Minnesota gives a green light to setting up a surrogacy industry in Minnesota, which includes surrogacy brokers, fertility doctors, pharmaceutical companies, lawyers, counselors, just to name a few, the responsible thing to do is to study the industry in greater detail. a diverse array of anti-poverty advocates, those concerned about human trafficking, religious leaders, bioethicists, scholars, and feminist leaders have expressed concerns and reservations about surrogacy worldwide. The European Parliament issued a resolution condemning surrogacy as a form of violence against women, and many countries such as Canada and most of Europe ban commercial surrogacy arrangements, as do a number of U.S. states already. The Prime Minister of France recently affirmed that his country would never legalize surrogacy. At the very least, these concerns should cause Minnesota to stop and think about how best to proceed with these commercial surrogacy arrangements in our state. Various opinions on how to regulate the issues related to surrogacy arrangements continue to be offered, from more regulation to bans on the commercial arrangements altogether. Despite the differing opinions, there is consensus that more needs to be known about surrogacy and the political, social, and economic impact of all of these arrangements. In 2014, a group of scholars and feminist leaders gathered at The Hague to discuss the global surrogacy business, and in just a few days produced a voluminous report that concludes, quote, "There is an urgent need for additional investigation by scholars and advocates and effective intervention by policymakers. The issues raised by commercial and inter-country surrogacy arrangements also call for broader public dialogue and thoughtful attention to their implications for our human future." Likewise, the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists has also recently stated, quote, "Many issues related to surrogate motherhood have not been resolved, and considerable disagreement persists within the medical profession, the medical ethics community, state legislature, the courts, and the general public. Similarly, no one position reflects the variety of opinions on surrogacy within ACOG's membership." And finally, a group of feminist scholars and activists recently wrote a piece in RH Reality Check and insisted, quote, "We know enough about on-the-ground conditions of commercial surrogacy to be convinced that caution is warranted and that the policies to help ensure everyone's rights and well-being are needed." The witness of a diverse array of activists and policy judgments of many states, nations, and people urge caution in this matter, and a commission is the most prudent course of action for the legislature to take. We recognize that many do not share our reservations about surrogacy, and that's why we are supporting this forum as a bipartisan positive step forward. It is structured in a way where all points of view can be heard, including proponents of surrogacy arrangements. We recognize that a commission report may not ultimately produce recommendations that are consistent with our views, but we believe that at a minimum, Minnesota will have addressed the many implications, both known and unknown, in surrogacy arrangements in a much more responsible way before simply enacting an industry-supported regulatory framework that leaves brokerages unregulated and merely ensures that a minimal framework is in place so that courts will not find surrogacy arrangements unconscionable, a route that backers of the surrogacy industry have been advocating for years in Minnesota. So again, Minnesota Family Council supports this commission as a very positive, responsible step forward on the issue of surrogacy arrangements. Thank you for your time.
Okay. Members, I think we're going to take all testimony, and then what we'll do is we'll open it up to questions at that time. Is there anyone else that wishes to testify to this bill? Welcome. If you can please state your name for the record and who you represent.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members. My name is Julie Berman, and I'm here representing Resolve, the National Infertility Association. I am a Minnesota resident and a board member of Resolve, a national nonprofit whose mission is to improve the lives of women and men living with infertility. Infertility is a common disease that affects 1 in 8 families. Resolve works on legislation in all 50 states in the U.S. Congress, and with that background, I'm here to share with you that we agree that legislation is needed in the area of gestational carrier surrogacy. The other testifier mentioned that Minnesota doesn't have any statutory guidelines on surrogacy, and that is true. Though many states are in that position, we have seen a trend where state legislators are taking this issue and putting forth legislation that regulates third-party reproduction to clearly establish parentage, to guide the courts in these cases, and to make best practices into law. These laws have been extremely helpful to the courts, physicians, intended parents, gestational carriers, and most importantly, the resulting children. In fact, in the last 3 years, 3 states have passed such legislation: New Hampshire, Nevada, and Delaware. Those states have codified into law the best practices of the medical, legal, and mental health field and included protections for gestational carriers so that no one can be exploited. Similar legislation is pending in Maryland, New York, and the District of Columbia. Instead of a legislative commission, Resolve would be very happy and willing to work with the Minnesota legislature on a comprehensive bill regulating gestational carrier surrogacy in Minnesota. In fact, we've supported past legislation in the state that would have helped the courts better determine parentage in these types of arrangements. Another reason that we support legislation instead of a study is that we do not believe there's a crisis regarding surrogacy arrangements and the use of gestational carriers to warrant a commission to study it. Medical guidelines, legal rules, and mental health best practices are in place to dictate gestational carrier agreements. These guidelines are set forth by the American Society of Reproductive Medicine, and they were updated this January, and they are based on the most recent recommendations of the CDC, the FDA, and the American Association of Tissue Banks. Women who choose to be gestational carriers for another couple, the intended parents, are treated under these medical guidelines to ensure that they are well informed about their choice. In addition, they go through rigorous psychological, medical, and legal evaluation, as do the intended parents. A few of those guidelines are worth stating here to give you a few examples of the depth to which they govern the process. Gestational carriers may be used when there's a true medical condition or biologic inability to conceive. Each party requires separate legal counsel. All participants are screened by trained mental health professionals. Gestational carriers should have previously experienced a full-term pregnancy before embarking on this process so they understand the true nature of carrying a pregnancy to term. All parties are counseled in the process and its potential risks. All parties are screened for medical concerns or issues. These are just an example of a few of the things that have been codified into law in New Hampshire and Delaware. In addition, the outcome of every IVF cycle, so that means every gestational carrier cycle, is reported to the CDC by federal law. Every IVF clinic has to abide by FDA guidelines. These are not fly-by-night operations. This is a very regulated field of operation of medicine. We feel strongly that there's a better approach, and we hope that you vote against this study and instead work with the infertility community and stakeholders, doctors, mental health professionals, attorneys, intended parents, and gestational carriers, on future legislation that will make a positive difference for Minnesota families. Thank you.
Okay, is there anyone else that wishes to testify to this bill? Welcome. If you can please state your name for the record and who you represent.
Sure. Yes, my name is Diana DePoister, Madam Chair and members. I don't have quite as much well-prepared remarks, but I just want to kind of share with you my perspective. I've been involved with Resolve, which is the same organization that the lady before me has been involved with for over 15 years now. I've personally done support groups that are faith-based in my own home for over 12 years. I have worked with at least 100 families who have experienced infertility, adoption, and beyond. And I also sat on a task force in 2003 that actually addressed this issue as I was president of Resolve, the local chapter at the time. We brought forth legislation at that time that addressed surrogacy and actually put barriers around the whole process. We put together legislation that would actually have solved the problems that apparently others think that exist today. I am not against legislating this. However, I am here to suggest that you need to put legislation in place that is workable and addresses the needs of all of your constituents. And you may not realize how many of your constituents go through infertility, and a part of that is surrogacy, and part of it is gestational carriers, and they are different. And anyway, I think that one of my questions as I've been sitting here listening is, do we require adoptive parents to tell their children when they are adopted? Do we require it by law? No, we don't. And as a parent of a child born of IVF, do we require people to tell their children? No. Are you required, if you have not gone through an infertility procedure, to tell your children how they were conceived exactly? No. And I think that if you are going to put any kind of task force together, and I discourage you to do that because I don't think that that would be helpful. We've already addressed those issues. And if you would like some help on some of those things, there are those of us who have experienced and have counseled people who have gone through this very difficult experience. And I also want to share with you that this is one of those things that until you've walked in someone else's shoes, you do not understand. And I am a walking example of that as well. And I think it's really important for you to understand your constituency here and to understand that if you put a task force in place, that it has to include the true stakeholders. And the true stakeholders are the parents, intended parents, and even children who have been conceived by this process. I as a part of the positive legislation, there do need to be guidelines and barriers. However, it is not something that needs to be banned. This is something that needs to be very carefully looked at by those who are affected and by those who have worked with couples that have experienced this difficult time in their lives. In our state, we have some of the best doctors in the country who monitor and who help with these procedures, and they do it in such a way that they put requirements around them, as do most of the agencies. The issues come up when there are not agreements put in place. Issues come up when there is not clarity on how to deal with these things. And for those things, yes, there does need to be guidelines in place. But I want you to understand, I'm a Christian person. And when I sat on this task force in 2002, I did a lot of soul searching. And I went to my church and I asked about it. And I want to tell you that the first surrogate was in the Bible. And so this is not something that hasn't been around for a long time. It's been happening for thousands of years. This is not something new. This is not something that that needs to be debated. It's something that needs to have some guidelines put around it, but needs to be understood and shared with people who have actually experienced it. And I'm talking both sides, because there are things that have happened to people that shouldn't have, because we don't have some requirements. I will say that. But when it is done properly, and in our state, it is mostly done properly by those agencies that I am aware of. And again, I have been dealing with this industry for over 15 years, and I advocate for it. I'm passionate about it because of the people and what I've seen happen with them. When you don't have the ability to have a child, you will go to great lengths. And this is one of them. And it is I just ask you all to think very cautiously about how you would feel if you were not able to have a child, and what lengths you might go to, having understood, if you do have children or grandchildren, how important those children are in your lives. I thank you for your time.
Great, thank you. Representative Scott?
Madam Chair, I'd be willing to take questions before I have closing remarks, or I can make remarks now. It's up to you.
Okay. Members, we have Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Scott, I think you've heard this concern before, but again, it has to do with the makeup of the commission, and that legislators obviously dominate. And when I look at the topics for studies, psychological effects, and legal considerations, so forth, it seems to me, listening to the testimony, even of the first testifier talked about scholars and advocates and mental health and medical professionals being important, providing analysis and information and recommendations, how important that was. It seems to me to be obvious that you'd want those kinds of professionals, and then we heard the testimony from this woman here, of people who have been affected by the by these issues, to be on the commission as well, to provide the kind of well-rounded discussion, input, and recommendations that I think this issue so richly deserves. I think it's a good discussion to have, and I appreciate you bringing it up and bring it forward, but I have a hard time with the commission as it is set, because I don't think you have the professional membership needed to really give the kind of fair, rounded analysis and policy discussion it deserves.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Johnson, for those questions. And there are a few reasons why I think a commission is better. There was a task force, as one of the previous testifiers said, and if I may quote from their findings, quote, they discovered that additional analysis and legislation are needed to address public policy concerns involving gestational agreements. So a task force did study it, and that included people that were other stakeholders outside of legislators and a few department folks that we have on this commission. Also, we want to get people involved that have no financial stake in the outcomes and the policy recommendations that may come out of this. We will certainly be having those folks, all the stakeholders, come in to testify. We want to hear from people that have been gestational carriers, have been children that have been born as a result of surrogacy. I think that we can do all those things and have legislators, along with department folks, thoroughly vet this subject. And certainly, by no means are we not sympathetic, I want to just say, to those that are struggling with infertility. All of us know someone that has been touched by that, and it's devastating to those families. And we're not saying this commission is going to study the pluses and the minuses and get parameters around what surrogacy should look like in the state of Minnesota.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, my concern is that it just become a, not just, but that it become largely a political discussion and political disagreements and arguments within the commission, rather than a sound and well-founded and well-rounded policy discussion with experts providing the kind of, and people who have been affected, the kind of recommendations and analysis that's needed. With legislators, I'm concerned that their political background might have way too much effect on what the outcome might be. That's my concern.
Representative Scott.
Madam Chair, thank you, and Representative Johnson. And that's why this is a very bipartisan commission. The leadership of both parties will be appointing people to this commission, and I think we're perfectly capable. There have been many other commissions that have been formed that have been bipartisan that have discussed issues and come up with recommendations and have been able to study an issue like this in a very unbiased way, looking at all the facts. This is a fact-finding mission, and I hope that that's the focus of everyone on this commission will be that's what we're doing. We're trying to find the facts. We're not bowing to any political stripe.
Okay. Representative Nash.
Madam Chair, thank you. Representative Scott, just for a quick piece of clarity, we heard some testimony urging us not to pass this because it would ban surrogacy. Is there anything in your bill that talks about banning surrogacy?
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Nash, no.
Madam Chair, thank
Representative
you.
Representative Nash.
Thank you.
Representative Lunin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My question would be the testifier from Resolve, either one of them.
Ms. Berman or Ms. DePoister.
And I appreciate the situations that couples are in regarding infertility. The my questions are a little more, I guess, financial in nature. So, so forgive me if they sound insensitive, but from a liability standpoint, if there's a if I'm involved in a car accident and I have a there's a surrogate carrier and that baby is injured, who all am I liable to? I mean, it seems like there's a whole bunch of complicated questions around this that we do need to take a look at.
Ms. Berman.
Yes, Representative. I agree. There are lots of questions, and that's why when people enter into a gestational carrier agreement, they sit down with separate legal counsel and go through all kinds of scenarios like the one
this
you just mentioned.
This other person is not a party to the contracts. Excuse me. Is not a party to the contract at all.
What other person? I'm sorry.
The person who caused the accident, for instance.
Oh.
Ms. Berman.
Yes. Sorry. Representative. I am not a legal expert. I am a patient advocate and somebody, a board member of Resolve. I can't answer the specifics of that, but what I can tell you is the two parties sit down and talk through all kinds of scenarios and discuss what happens in all kinds of scenarios.
Representative Lunin.
Andy.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. And another question I would have would be regarding employee benefits, how employers of all the parties involved who I'm assuming they're not a party to the contract either. It just seems like these are things that should be at least discussed or be proactive about. What the precedence is for that?
Ms. Berman or Ms. DePoyce?
I want to make sure you understand every agreement is different. However, there is no difference. Well, let me address. I'm not sure if I'm getting the crux of your question, but in terms of employee benefits, are you asking the question of who takes care of that?
Representative Lunin.
Well, I come from an insurance background,
right.
And there's some tails on this, and you've got the employer of the caring mother.
Yes, okay.
And you've got the employee of the other mother, and as far as the benefits that are offered.
Yes. When it is done properly.
Ms. DePoister.
I'm sorry. When it is done properly, there is usually a separate insurance policy that is purchased to cover that pregnancy. And so it is not generally, if it is done properly, a part of an employee benefit. And I'm not sure the crux of your previous question, but I think you are going to whose liability and what happens with that child if it's injured. That is usually, when it is done properly, addressed within the contract. And as are many, many other issues, and it is typically the parents are given many different options, just as you are with any pregnancy that you have.
Representative Lunin, any follow-up?
Two final comments. First of all, I agree with Representative Johnson as far as hoping that we move forward with this. It isn't a stat committee, that there is some objectivity. The other thing is in my district, we had a relatively high-profile surrogacy, and 2 weeks ago, the caring mother went in and gave birth to a beautiful set of twins. So it's a little change in the game plan there. Thank you.
Representative Carlson.
Yeah, Madam Chair, I'm just trying to follow the fiscal note. Maybe staff or Mr. Hubinger could comment, because we're requiring the Legislative Coordinating Commission to provide staffing and administrative support. And the fiscal note says $26,000. And
thank you.
We don't really say in the bill how that money is necessarily appropriated,
and
whether that $26,000, it appears, covers the cost of perhaps per diem for the commission members, but there's also the requirement of staffing, and maybe Mr. Hubinger or committee staff could comment on just what the impact of the bill is beyond the per diem payment for the commissioners.
Ms. Roberts?
I'm trying to get a handle on what that expertise would be.
Sure. And Representative Carlson, I think Ms. Roberts has an answer to that. And I do I'm under my understanding that that would be for compensation for members that are serving on the commission. But can you clarify, Ms. Roberts?
Yes, Madam Chair and Representative, if you look at page 9 and 10 of the fiscal note, you'll see that the $26,000 is the estimated cost for per diem and also round-trip mileage and lodging for the portion of task force members that would be eligible for that. There is staff time that will be provided by both the House and Senate and the LCC, but the time and cost for that staff time would be absorbed. So that's estimated at about $4,000 for the time that would be spent over the period of the task force meetings. So the $26,000 is the membership reimbursement and costs. There is not an appropriation in this bill. So if the bill was, depending on the path of the bill, if it was laid over for inclusion, that could be considered within the omnibus bill. If it moved separately, then the committee would want to consider.
Yeah, and then, Madam Chair, that was my initial comment, was trying to track just how this appropriation is being made. There's reference, as I mentioned in my comments, to covering the per diem, and then there's reference to the staffing being provided, and so part of my question was, I'm not sure what kind of expertise the LAC would have in this regard, and whether $4,000 really covers that. Maybe Mr. I don't know who made reference or who came up with the $4,000. Maybe that was Mr. Hubinger. I'm just wondering if that's really covering the cost of this commission or not.
Well, Representative Carlson, all the fiscal notes are prepared in consultation with anybody that is impacted by it. And Ms. Roberts, I believe that Mr. Hubinger's office has been contacted. Can you verify that he signed off on this fiscal note?
Madam Chair and representatives, yes, the portion of the fiscal note that details the costs was actually prepared by the LCC. And so the estimates came from the LCC in consultation with House and Senate staff. And the estimate is for specifically for the House and Senate that they would provide research analyst support of 2 hours per meeting. And then there are additional administrative and fiscal support costs for the LCC that aren't detailed, but if you would like additional information, we can get it.
Yeah, I guess I'm not going to challenge the fiscal note other than my point was that $4,000 just seemed a little bit on the light side, but maybe they have enough staffing in-house to accomplish that. But the bill still doesn't appropriate the $26,000.
And Representative Carlson, I neglected to say that this is going to be held over for possible inclusion in the omnibus finance bill. I would probably make the recommendation to Representative Scott to think hard about the compensation piece of the bill. We wouldn't need to necessarily compensate the members for serving on the committee. We've done that many times in other places, although there are other commissions that do pay per diem, but I don't necessarily see that as a mandatory requirement for this. But that's up to her. That's part of her bill. So that's kind of the thought process for it.
And Madam Chair, if I might.
And Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I know on the Data Practices Commission, there's also been the Minnesota Sports Facilities and the Commission on Metropolitan Governance, all of which members are given their per diem, basically, and reimbursed for reasonable expenses. So we would certainly be willing to
change that language and make it more accommodating financially. Also, the commission, if you look at the fiscal note, it based the fiscal note on 10 meetings, and certainly that can be a lower number if, you know, I wouldn't want to have any less than six, but somewhere between 6 and 10 meetings would also, if it went from 10 meetings to six, it'd save about $7,000.
Great. Members, any other questions to this bill? All right, seeing none, I'm going to renew. Representative Nash is going to renew his motion that House File 437 be laid over for possible inclusion in the state government under this finance bill. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed?
No.
The bill is laid over, and we have Representative Barrett is here with House File 1694.
Is that the first bill?
This is really good.
And Representative Pugh, you want to move House File 1694?
Yes, I'll move House File 1694.
And Representative Barrett, this is going to be laid over for possible inclusion in the Omnibus State Government Finance Bill. If you could speak to your bill and give us an idea of what it does. I don't see any amendments, so I think we're good, correct?
That is correct, Madam Chair. So, Madam Chair, I'll give you a brief highlights of the bill. Then I do have a testifier here who can go over in detail the bill. And if you have any questions, both of us would be happy to answer them. So the bill creates a process for evaluating economic incentives that Minnesota spends to incite jobs and economic development in our state. That process would happen through the Office of Legislative Auditor. And why is this bill necessary? I mentioned we spend millions upon millions of dollars giving money for a particular purpose. We evaluate those processes sporadically, if at all. And I think if we had a process for evaluating those on a more regular basis, we would do better, do more things than are good and do fewer things than are bad and spend our money wisely. Rigorous independent evaluation can help determine which incentives are working, which are not, and how to create jobs and grow the economy in the most effective way possible. That's my summary. And as I mentioned, we have a testifier here.
Great. And Mr. Goodman, if you can please state your name for the record and who you represent.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members, and thank you so much for your time. My name is Josh Goodman, and I'm a senior researcher with the Pew Charitable Trust State Economic Development Incentives Project.
This is a Pew bill.
And Pew is a public charity that engages in research and technical assistance at the local, state, and federal levels of government. And we've been researching economic development incentives for the last 5 years. HF 1694 will help answer a question that I hear constantly from lawmakers in Minnesota and all over the country. How can we create quality jobs and grow our economy most effectively? Minnesota, like most states, provides businesses with tax credits, grants, and loans as a key part of its economic development strategy. And even though incentives are important for states' budgets and economies, lawmakers often lack good information on the results of these programs. They are forced to make decisions based on anecdotes rather than hard evidence. By requiring the legislative auditor to evaluate at least one economic development incentive program each year, this bill would ensure that you have the information that you need. Our research shows that regular, rigorous, independent evaluations can help determine which incentives are working, which are not, and how to improve the effectiveness of these policies. These legislative audit reports could answer key questions for you, such as whether incentive programs are being administered effectively, whether you're encouraging businesses to create jobs they otherwise would not have created, and how Minnesota's economy as a whole is being affected. One particularly innovative aspect of this bill is that it also requires the legislative auditor to publish a report on best practices for exclusive incentives once every 4 years. And exclusive incentives are defined as incentives that the legislature approves for specific companies or projects. As you all know, they've been a big part of the conversation over incentives in Minnesota in recent years. And so the idea of focusing on best practices is to give the legislature guidance to make informed decisions about exclusive incentives in the future. The legislative auditor would describe things like how you can ensure that these kinds of deals create high-quality jobs and how they can be monitored appropriately. And this provision is just one reason this bill would make Minnesota a national leader. HF 1694 is part of a trend we're seeing across the country. From 2012 to 2014, 10 states and the District of Columbia enacted laws that will require regular evaluation of all major economic development tax incentives or will improve existing evaluation processes. And that momentum is continuing this year.
No.
Just last week, the governor of North Dakota signed similar legislation into law, while evaluation bills are advancing in other states, including Nebraska and Oklahoma.
I know.
Support for regular evaluation crosses political lines. In each of these 10 states, the bills passed on strong bipartisan votes. Lawmakers who tend to be supportive of incentives and those who are more inclined to be skeptical are coming together around the idea that measuring the results of these programs is important. The reason for this broad support is that high-quality evaluations are a proven way to make economic development work better. When evaluations show that incentives are working well, states have invested in programs with confidence. And states have also been able to identify subtle changes to incentives that will get better results for businesses and taxpayers, and they've reformed programs that weren't meeting the state's goals. By approving this bill, Minnesota can make sure incentives are working as well as they possibly can for the state's economy, budget, and people. And thanks so much for your time, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Okay. Is there anyone else that wishes to testify to this bill? Okay, members, questions? Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Barrett. Well, I don't disagree that evaluating the effectiveness of these programs is a good idea. The question I have is, this is kind of outside the process we normally do for giving stuff for the legislative auditor to look at. We're currently, and I guess we have to have those in by Friday, our pick of the ones that, of the topics that were suggested, of our four picks of what we want them to look at, and they're going to tabulate those. The concern I have here with this is that we're legislating, put it in law, statute, what we want the legislative auditor to do every year. And is it the next one going to be, the bill going to be, have them evaluate programs that the Department of Health does, or the Department MnDOT does, and pretty soon, I know the legislative auditor has his fiscal note says there's no cost, but are we going to overload his plate so much that he can't do anything, and we're basically going to eliminate our choice of what we want to look at every year? You know, and I know the legislative auditor in the past has said he'll do whatever we tell him to do, but at some point, he's either going to grow a huge department and have to deal with all this stuff, or things aren't going to get done. And I know he said that in the past, I'll do whatever you want, but that means if I have too much time for this, that means some of this other stuff that I do isn't going to get done because of it. So that's a concern I have with this bill. And setting it in statute as opposed to doing it through our normal process.
Representative Barrett?
Sure. Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Nelson. Excellent question. It's a question that we have in creating the bill and amending the bill and having the bill in the shape it is right now, we've struggled with. The fiscal note is zero because we've talked to the legislative auditor, Office of Legislative Auditor, and if you'd like, there's a representative of that department here today. She'd be happy to speak on the issue. We've been assured that they can do this work through normal channels, through normal resources, without adding anything additional. Why do we pick this? Because it's important. We spend millions, if not billions, of dollars on economic incentives. If another issue rose to that level of expenditure, it might be appropriate to add resources. But with this bill, the fiscal note is zero, and for good reason, because we didn't want to overload that department. If you'd like to have the OLA come up, they'd be happy to do so.
We've got it on the fiscal note that actually says from the legislative auditor's office to that effect. But Representative Nelson, any follow-up questions?
Yes, Madam Chair, and this is more of a statement. We don't need to have the legislative auditor come up because, as I said in my question, in the past, Mr. Nobles and the legislative auditor department has said they can do this work. If we keep loading stuff on his plate by making him do this and making him do that, and we've had numerous ones come through GovOps, and I think a couple have come through here already, the two committees usually meet back-to-back, so I kind of mesh them two together in my mind at times. But we've had a lot of them where we're giving more duties to the legislative auditor. And like I said, in past years when he's been asked whether he can do this, he's basically said what Representative Barrett said. He said is that, yes, I can do this in our normal scope. But at some point, he's also said that at some point, if I get too much stuff put on my plate, some stuff's going to fall off. It's sort of like going to the buffet on Easter Sunday and floating your plate up and to the point where things fall off the plate, you don't have, can't get to it all. And I think that's concern I have that we're going outside
there,
the normal.
Is that a recent memory? Or?
Actually, no, I didn't go to buffet this year. But we all know how that works. So that's just my concern. And so and that's I wanted it on tape. So
great. All right,
Madam Chair.
Representative Barrett.
So regarding the buffet analogy, I use the 10-second rule myself. So
very nice, Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Barrett, I'm just trying to understand from more of a practical perspective. Could you give me an example over the last year or even this year about what would be an economic development incentive program, whether general incentive or exclusive incentive that would be the type that we're referring to that we'd want analyzed just so folks understand what it is we're talking about on a very practical level?
Representative Barrett.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative. Well, we have evaluated economic incentives in the past sporadically. I can give you a couple examples of what we've done to give you a kind of a general thought about what could be done with other incentives. But 2014, we evaluated the state's angel investment tax credit. And in that, we found some areas to improve. Some of the angels weren't necessarily arm's length angels. And so we thought that some of the incentive might have happened anyway because of the relationship with the angel and the organization. So I think either I don't want to speak to the legislation because I wasn't involved in it, but I think things were tightened up in that regard. Back in 2008, the legislative auditor evaluated the Job Opportunity Building Zone program, and it created numerous recommendations for the legislature to look at. Those would be two areas. In other states, New Mexico has had some incentive programs that they have evaluated in which they gave incentives to both smaller companies and larger companies, finding that the larger companies would have done that particular idea or initiative anyway. The smaller companies wouldn't have, so they made some changes to the law so that it only affected those that would actually be incentivized by the tax credit.
Representative Barrett, I understand there's going to be an announcement later on. I think it's today regarding a bonding bill proposal. Would it also include bonding bills that are declared to be job providers or, increase in jobs as economic development?
Well, the description is in, it starts on line 1.12.
And I read through that, Representative Barrett, and that's why I asked, because I didn't see anything specifically that
I don't think it would.
Unless that's considered as part of an economic state program, would that be included?
If it required tax money. So a tax incentive, tax exemption, tax deduction, grant, loan, credit, it would depend on the particular situation. Right now, given the fact that we know the OLA has limited resources, we are asking for one program to be evaluated each year. I think this is a baseline. I think once we look at the results over time, we might want to do more of it, just like the words in the document. If the incentive is working, we do more. If the incentive isn't working, we do less. I think that process can go with this bill as well. If the bill actually gets passed into law, creates good government, and we want to do more good government, we expand it. If it's not working, we don't.
Okay, so because debt service is using tax dollars, then that would probably be included as part of a review then. Is that your assumption?
I think, Mr. well...
Representative Barrett.
Thank you. You're putting me on the spot, Madam Chair.
I apologize. I'm asking, so... And if you don't know, that's fine. We can find out later.
I probably would want to seek counsel to make sure that bonding would be included or not included.
Sure. Sure. No, I get you. All right. We've got Representative Lane. Representative Lane.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just following up on that, I actually would like to have this evaluation done. And I know that the OLA does agencies on a constant basis. Certain things are done by the OLA on a constant basis. The jobs program that you mentioned, I believe, was through our normal legislative process of putting things in that have current interest of what we would like to know about, which is our usual process. I guess I would like to hear from the OLA how this fits between the current need for legislators to want something studied and the constant need that the OLA does to constantly review agencies on a not annual basis, but on a regular basis.
Okay. We have someone from the OLA's office. And Representative Johnson, I apologize. I interrupted your train of questions, so I'll come back to you after Representative Lane. If you can please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. For the record, my name is Judy Randall. I'm with the Program Evaluation Division of the Legislative Auditor's Office. This would be a little bit of a twist, I think, on our current process. And Representative Nelson, thanks for the plug regarding get your surveys in regarding topic selection. They are due on Friday. Thanks for that. Regarding handling economic incentives, I think what we envision now, although the process would have to tweak a little, is right now we do about 6 to 8 program evaluations each year, and you all select those. You know, the Audit Commission selects them, and then your preferences are shown on that survey. I think what we would do is basically hold one slot of those 6 to 8 program evaluations for an economic incentive program evaluation. And so if you can imagine on the current survey that's on your desk, there would be the the column with all the topics and then the column with the economic incentive program topics. And so you would still have some selection among those economic incentive programs and then among the general programs. So we would still hopefully be timely and respond to current interests, but kind of reserving one slot for economic incentive programs. And then regarding Representative Lane, kind of our regular presence at agencies, that's really through our financial audit program, where they are kind of, they can set the schedule based on risk and current needs and identified areas of focus. And so they're doing a kind of a regular presence through financial audits. The program evaluations are selected by the Audit Commission.
Representative Lane?
I just want to make that clear. The program evaluations are selected by the Audit Commission, which includes us. Putting it in statute is a little bit different, but I appreciate your clarification as to how you would handle that.
And Representative Johnson, did you have any follow-up questions?
No, my question was answered, okay. Madam Chair, thanks.
Great. Representative Earhart, did you have a question?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was wondering if whatever the Plenty Zones were called one time, would anybody ever do any work on those, the Pew Trust or legislative auditor? I know that there were things going around that things didn't seem to be doing what they were supposed to be doing. So can anybody tell me about that? Was there an audit or what?
Mr. Goodman or Ms. Randall, did we do any evaluation of Job Z zones? Or Representative Barrett, if you have any feedback on that.
Madam Chair, Representative Barrett, we did an evaluation in 2008 on Job Z and had a number of recommendations. But regarding what happened with those recommendations, I'm not.
Well, that was my question. Once we
Representative Earhart.
Madam Chair, once we get the information, did we do anything with it?
Okay. Well, and Representative Earhart, would you like a copy of that at all, or are you good? Of the Job Z evaluation from 2008?
Not unless there was something done about it. I don't want to just hear that we found out things were wrong and we didn't do anything, because that's what we're talking about here.
Okay.
I don't think that there's a remarkable improvement in the way we operated those zones, as a matter of fact. That was during the Plenty administration.
Okay. Ms. Randall?
Madam Chair, Representative Earhart, I believe we have a follow-up impact report that I can get to you in terms of what happened as a result of our evaluation.
Thank you.
And Mr. Goodman, did you want to comment to that?
Thanks, Madam Chair. Just briefly, that report was one. We put out a 50-state report on how states are evaluating their tax incentives in 2012, and the Job Z report was one that we cited in that report. And I'm sure the follow-up report you referenced will have more detail, but there were a variety of changes that were made in response to that report in terms of sort of how the program was administered, how much discretion local governments had to, provide incentives, and what the state role was, standards for determining who was eligible, things like that, sort of subtle changes that were designed to make the program more effective.
Thank you.
Okay. Representative Barrett, any closing comments?
Madam Chair, no. Well, other than the fact, I know you had mentioned you want to lay it over. Is that, I don't know if that's your recommendation. That'd be great. There is no fiscal note for this, so I know there's Section 5 talked about finances and money, and because of what the OLA can do within their current jurisdiction, there is no fiscal impact to this bill.
Great. Members, with that, I renew, or Representative Pugh renews her motion that House File 1694 be laid over for possible inclusion in the Omnibus State Government Finance Bill. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed? And okay, your bill is laid over, and thank you, Representative Barrett.
Thank you.
Members, we are going to go hear from Representative Lunan.
Madam Chair,
Representative Lunan moves House File 1793. Representative Lunan, if you can explain your bill.
This bill deals with the Horse Racing Commission and the powers within. We have a new commissioner, and it comes with a strong administrative background, and it's cleaning up some of the statutes and making sense of some of the fees, having a relationship between the fees and what the problems the fees are designed to take care of. We're one of the components of the bill is to eliminate the $100 cap on licensures out there. The licensures that are out at the horse track involve anything from farriers who clip the toenails of the horses, if you will, to the bally and the mega gambling institutions that are out there. And we feel that a more equitable fee should be charged for some of the bigger entities that are coming away with a lot of profits from there. It also tightens up the relationship between the card club. The legislature in the past has authorized to create revenue to increase the purses to improve horse racing in Minnesota, to formalize that a little bit. I have a testifier here today from the commissioner's office that can go through some of the other details of the bill.
Okay, if you can please state your name for the record and who you represent.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I'm Joe Skirto, Deputy Director of the Minnesota Racing Commission. The bill you have before you contains changes to clarify and to simplify language within Chapter 240, which guides the racing and card playing industry in Minnesota. The bill also contains two provisions or changes that have fiscal elements, which I will briefly outline for you today. The modification in Section 10 would allow the MRC to change the current term of designated Class C occupational licenses from 1 year up to 3 years. Our intent is to only extend this term for horse owners initially, but provide the ability to implement for other classes in the future. The three-year license provision is something that was brought to us by our constituents and the people within the industry. It is a revenue-neutral provision. A number of other jurisdictions throughout the country currently offer three-year licenses, including New York, California, Los Angeles, Pennsylvania, and a number of others. It will provide the MRC an estimated $75,000 in initial cash flow, positive introduction of cash flow, but of course that will be dissipated over the next 2 years as the licenses expire. The provision would also benefit the MRC in some reduction of administrative costs due to just licensing some categories for once every 3 years. The second provision or change is in Section 12, which would remove the $100 ceiling on Class C occupational licenses. This change would allow the Commission, through a rulemaking process, and with the future approval of the Governor and the Legislature, to create new vendor categories and raise fees on those companies that benefit most from our industry, or have the most influence on the operational integrity of card playing and wagering within the state. Currently, the nice lady that sells fresh peanuts at Canterbury Park pays a $100 vendor license fee. Counter to that, Bally's Gaming, as the representative pointed out, pays the same $100. So there's an inequity there that needs to be addressed. Gaming vendors in other jurisdictions, such as Iowa, pay $1,000 for their license. Indiana, $7,500. Michigan, $5,000. Ohio, Pennsylvania, also $5,000. Here in Minnesota, $100. Additionally, by removing the cap, the Racing Commission would be better able to allocate the cost of regulation to those who require additional investigation and oversight. The Commission staffs stewards, judges, veterinarians, testing labs, investigators, just to ensure that trainers, jockeys, drivers, card dealers are playing within the rules. Conversely, a student working summers at Running Aces behind the concession stand who needs very little oversight by the commission pays the same license fees as those others. This change would allow us to provide a better correlation between the regulation activities and the costs associated with the occupation itself. The $100 cap has been in effect since enabling legislation for racing back in 1983. Two categories were added in 2003 and one in 2008, but no general increases since at least 1999 that we were able to go back and find. We haven't seen anything since the turn of the century. This change is estimated to create an additional $107,000 in additional licensing revenue, which represents approximately a 12.8% increase in overall license fee revenue for the commission. Keep in mind, though, this is not an across-the-board increase. It is really, we are focusing in on the vendors and the gaming vendors that we regulate to generate the majority of that increase. In summary, if this bill becomes law, both of these changes outlined would still have to go through a rulemaking process, gaining input from the industry and consensus, receive governor's approval as well as approval from the legislature. Finally, neither of these provisions outlined will have any impact on the general fund. I'm happy to answer any questions and respectfully ask for your support in moving this bill forward.
Is there anybody else that wishes to testify to this bill? Representative Kahn.
Is there any thought for these licenses of working some way in some percentage of the receipts?
Representative.
Does any racetrack do that or any place do that?
Mr. Skirtle?
Madam Chair, Representative, yes, there are some jurisdictions. As a matter of fact, I believe it's Pennsylvania that uses a percentage. Yes, it is Pennsylvania. They anywhere between $5,000 and $25,000 based on their annual revenue into the industry.
That Representative Kahn?
Kind of looks like a better idea to me in terms of being able to. You know, I don't know what the percentage should be. There must be something that could be negotiated and agreed on. But then it just depends on the level of business. So,
Mr. Skirto, have you guys considered that?
Madam Chair, Representative, this is something that we certainly will consider. And as we sit down with all the industry participants and so forth, we'll outline some of those details and certainly we'll take that into mind.
Okay. Representative Johnson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Loon, have you heard any opposition to this bill as it's laid out here?
Representative Loon?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative. When this bill was put together by Commissioner DePasquale, he worked with all the stakeholders, and we did do some compromising. So we have peace in the valley on this bill. To speak to Representative Kahn's comment, I think the goal here with the fees is to put into the recipe, not necessarily the gross receipts, but the benefits, the profits that an entity gets at the track, and then also what cost of oversight the state is incurring in babysitting them, and so that the relationship is a fairer one.
And Representative Kahn to that point?
Well, on sales, like on sales of drinks and so forth, is sales tax collected at the track?
Mr. Skirto?
Madam Chair, Representative, yes it is. Sales tax is generated.
All right. Okay. Members, any other questions? Representative Detmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and the testifier. Are both the parks, Canterbury and Running Aces, they both are treated the same on this legislation?
Representative Lunan or Mr. Skirto?
Yep, they're under the same racing commission, so they are treated equally. Both are a great family experience. They've got multi types of entertainment there, and They've got some business relationships that are unique to each one with some businesses around them. I happen to be down in the Shakopee area, and we're in the River South, so there's some opportunities there that are running aces don't have. But other than that, from a regulatory standpoint, they're the same.
And to expand upon that, is licensing is exactly the same regardless of what racetrack individuals may work at.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Lunin or Mr. Skirto, the ladies selling our peanuts at the track, you're not anticipating huge increases for that person. What you're looking at is to go at the ones that are making lots of money at the top end. I hate to have drive that lady out of business by raising her fees so much that it costs more than her profit for the year selling peanuts.
Mr. Skirto.
Madam Chair, Representative, that's exactly our position. We want to keep those constant and have a vendor classification that is basically for individuals or sole proprietors versus those that may be on the high end, such as a Bally's Gaming. That's exactly correct.
Okay. All right. With that, members, Representative Lunin renews his motion that House File 1793 be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus state government finance bill. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed? All right. Great. Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Nash, House File 1805. Representative Nash moves House File 1805 to be laid over in the omnibus state government finance bill.
Let the record that I'm providing.
Oh, wow.
Ooh.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, members.
We appreciate your diligence. Representative Lunin, on the other hand, neglected his duty. So, go ahead, Representative.
Madam Chair, I'd like to move House File 1805 for inclusion.
There we go.
I'd like to move House File 1805. Members, you may remember earlier in the year when Mr. Goldsmith came and told us some of his plans for 2015 that he didn't want to spend some of the money this year. That struck me as refreshing. And he and I chatted afterwards to put together a bill that would allow him to do certain things. It is contained in House File 1805, and I think that it's a good bill. I think that there should be fairly wide bipartisan support. And he's here to tell you exactly what it does and what it doesn't do, but would hand it over to him.
Yeah. Mr. Goldsmith.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. My name is Gary Goldsmith. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Campaign Finance and Public Disclosure Board. There are actually two sections in this bill. Section 1, and by the way, neither section has a fiscal impact. Section 1 clears up some technical language in Section 211B.37, which relates to the Office of Administrative Hearings. I think I've mentioned this before, this committee before, but I'm not sure. This actually is also in the board's technical bill, which is essentially the policy bill. And just briefly, historically, $130,000 per biennium was allocated from the public subsidy program to the Office of Administrative Hearings for handling complaints against candidates that are under the jurisdiction of Chapter 10A in the board. And that happened up through 2009. At that point, the decision was made that it made more sense just to give that money directly to the OAH. It was set aside from the public subsidy appropriation, and OAH billed against it until 2009, when $130,000 was then directly appropriated to OAH, and the appropriation to the public subsidy program was reduced by that same amount. The problem in 2009 was that the language in 211B.37 that told OAH to bill against that public subsidy program money wasn't deleted, and it should have been at that time, because at that time and since then they've gotten that money directly. I've talked to Chief Justice to the Chief Justice of the OAH, and in fact she said she would not be able to be here this morning, but was happy to know that I would be here. And they haven't billed against that appropriation, of course, since 2009. They recognize this is obsolete language, and so we felt it was appropriate to put it in the budget bill to remove that language. So that's Section 1. Section 2 is the provision that Representative Nash was particularly talking about, and I've talked to you about this provision before. We have money in our appropriation because we got an increase a couple of years ago to do some technology projects, including the website, which is our top priority right now, and significant resources. All available resources are being devoted to that project, and that's not just a catchphrase. I am actually managing the agency so that I can defer staff time from other projects where I can take them and devote them to the web development project. Considerable amount of that money is going to need to be spent, though, on both OAH services and outside consultants, as well as MinGeo, which is also, I'm sorry, I said OAH, Minute Services, including MinGeo, and outside developers. And we realized that because we got off to a slower start than we wanted, we really would not be able to effectively and efficiently spend about $150,000 of our budget this year, or this biennium. We could have spent it. I could have put on a couple of developers and rushed them into some things, but without appropriate planning, that money would not have been as effectively spent as it will be if this bill is passed. And so what this bill does is it allows us to move $150,000 forward from this biennium into the next biennium. It does that by means of a cancellation of the current biennium appropriation and then a reappropriation in the next biennium. The result of that is that there is no fiscal impact, and it will not have any effect on the budget targets for this committee because you'll be able to take both the negative cancellation as well as the new appropriation, and they'll cancel each other out. And the bill does also require reporting back to the committees that have financial and policy jurisdiction over the board so that we can assure you that we did, in fact, use this carry-forward money in the way that we promise and intend to do that. I will mention one last thing, and that is that in the governor's change items under the MMB non-operating component of the governor's recommendations is a provision that would allow all state agencies to carry forward unexpended money from one biennium to the next. Should the committee decide to include that provision in its omnibus budget bill, then our provision would not be necessary. Strictly from an administrator standpoint, that actually is preferable because it gives us the authority to do that in future years. Typically, we're talking about $10,000, $20,000, or $30,000 at the end of a biennium, and we do use it appropriately because we need every penny we get. So with that, I'll stand for questions, Madam Chair.
Okay. Is there anybody from the public that wishes to testify to this bill? Members, questions? Representative Runbeck.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Goldsmith, perhaps you covered it and I missed it, but in 2014, apparently there was not money spent on the project, the website development, and was there a reason for that?
Mr. Goldsmith.
Madam Chair, Representative Runbeck, there was some, but it was fairly minimal. We were working on primarily the hardware back end. As I think I've explained to this committee before, agencies that want to have data-driven pages, web pages, are required to run their own servers because the main web server that Minute operates does not facilitate hosting databases and interactive data. So that part is built now, including both the hardware and the software. Of course, that wasn't visible to anybody in any way. So some money was spent, but we had approximately $150,000 per calendar year available, and so we are behind, and that's why we have this excess money, yes.
Representative Runbeck.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay. Members, any other questions?
Yes.
Representative Kahn.
I think I asked this before in an earlier meeting, but I've kind of managed to forget it, which is what connection do you have with Minute for the developing of the website and so forth?
Mr. Goldsmith.
Madam Chair, Representative Kahn, we use Minute to the extent that they are available to provide those services. So they'll be hosting the non-database component of the website. They'll be developing the components of the site itself that don't have to access the database, but our developers will develop the website, the database access component. And we'll be using MinGeo, which is also now under Minute.
Yes. Yeah, right.
Representative Kahn.
I assume this has been a good cooperation and it's worked well on all sides.
Mr. Goldsmith.
Let me say that there have been some frustrations, but it's working, yes.
Okay.
Okay.
I'll let Representative Nash take care of it.
There you go.
Madam Chair, Representative Kahn, I think that's part of why we're doing this, is the initial slowdown was in part due to, I would say, probably some confusion as to what Minute does and what Minute doesn't do. and Mr. Goldsmith articulated that to both here in the committee and then in my office later, that it really was in part due to what they chose to do and what they don't do. And Mr. Eichten himself has told me in my office, and I believe here in the committee, that they may not choose to do any of this moving forward. So this is an appropriation to get them what they need to better serve candidates and the public, and I think it's a good bill.
Great.
Okay. Members, with that, Representative Nash renews his motion to lay over House File 1805 for possible inclusion in the Omnibus State Government Finance Bill. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed? Okay. Members, with that, we are going to have more bills tomorrow and on Thursday. We start at 8:15. I can't officially call the meeting to order until we have members present. So hopefully we'll get a chance to see you tomorrow at 8:15. Thank you.